This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. If you celebrated Thanksgiving yesterday, I hope it was a good one, spent with family, eating good food, reflecting on what you're thankful for. And given the holiday's historical roots, it's also a good time to reflect on how indigenous Americans fared after colonization. You had wars, forced relocation, and disease. All took their toll, and the legacy of colonization is still felt by Native Americans today, even, it turns out, in their DNA. New research published in Nature Communications assesses the impact of European colonization on the genes of one indigenous group of British Columbia, finding in their DNA evidence of devastation from disease, smallpox included, in the 19th century. The researchers compared samples from ancient remains of people in the Prince Rupert Island area to living members of the Tsimshian First Nation, and they found changes in their immune systems and evidence of a huge loss of life about 200 years ago. Lead author on that research is Dr. Rippon Molly. He's a genetic anthropologist and associate professor at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. He joins us from Tampa, Florida. Also with us is Barbara Petzl. She is treaty coordinator at the Metlakatla Treaty Office. She's an archaeologist and part of the research team. And she joins us from Metlakatla in British Columbia, Canada. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, great to be here.
Thanks for having me.
The Metlakatla are a First Nation within the Tsimshian. Is that correct, Barbara?
Yes, they're one of seven of the Tsimshian First Nations.
And Dr. Molly, how different were the genes you looked at between the ancient and modern groups of Tsimshians?
Well, for the whole genome, or the genome-wide scan that we did, the ancient individuals and the living individuals were very similar, so much so that we could suspect that they are a continuous population. But for specific genomic regions, we found signals of natural selection in the ancient individuals, specifically at genes related to immunity. And so this suggested that the ancient individuals were actually adapted to any pathogens in their ancient environments.
And how did they lose that immunity then?
Well, it seemed that that after European contact, that other pathogens were brought over from Europe. And one possibility is that these ancient genetic variants that were well adapted to ancient pathogens were no longer adapted to the current pathogens that Europeans brought over. And so these genetic variants changed dramatically as a result of that in the living community members.
Barbara, how much of this research is new information to you?
Well, considering a lot of this information was passed down in our oral histories and through the archaeological record, not much of it is actually surprising. The interesting part is that it's actually shown in our genetics. So that part is a little surprising and pretty exciting.
Yeah, well, tell me why. What's so exciting about it?
Well, the science is catching up to be able to show that the genetic shift in one population from ancient descendants into the modern descendants. Like in previous study, we've already, meaning the geneticists, have already proven that there is a genetic link between the ancient ancestors, the ancient remains from the sites within the territory, and with the modern descendants. And to go the step further to show that the smallpox epidemic, for example, that occurred within the region at the time of contact and just after in the early historic period actually shows up in our genetics is pretty interesting and, from what I understand, quite groundbreaking.
And Dr. Molly, how do you think the Tsimshian can use this data? Does anything also excite you about these findings?
Oh, yes. I think this the results that we found were really exciting, in part because this is, at least in the Americas, the first time that we've been able to show through a study of genetics of a continuous population before and after European contact what the effects of European colonization was. The other part of this that I think is really interesting is the partnership that we have with the Metlakatla and the Coast Tsimshian. So it was a study where we both decided what we wanted to study and how we wanted to study it.
So are you saying this is a unique partnership that hasn't happened before?
It rarely happens in anthropology and genetics, a partnership between a team of researchers at an academic university and indigenous communities. What's happened a lot in the past is that researchers would go into a community, get the samples that they needed, and then they would leave, rarely coming back to report any results. And so we didn't want to follow that model. And so what we did is met with the communities, decided what would be a mutually beneficial study, and then we would come back year after year to report on our results and discuss the results with community members and folks like Barbara and Joycelyn Mitchell, our community collaborators.
Barbara, so you and the community welcomed this then?
Like Ripon said, there were things that we wanted to get out of it as well, you know, like proving the genetic link between Metlakatla modern descendants and the ancient ancestors from sites within the territory, and also aid in the advancement of science, which also helps with the yearly results reporting. We think it might actually inspire some of the younger members to go into sciences.
You mean the youngsters who were part of this study might say, hey, you know, there's a door open to science that I never thought I might walk into?
That's a hope. We've had a focus before on archaeology, and some of the members have started showing an interest in becoming field assistants, and hopefully we'll further their education in that. And with the genetics research, we're hoping, too, that, you know, maybe some of the members might be inspired to go into sciences.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Molly, does collaborating with indigenous communities ever lead to changes in your research questions or your methods?
Oh, absolutely. Yes. So we discuss our methods that we are planning to use, and often through this type of discussion, we end up changing our research methods. A good example would be not with the Metlakatla, but with another community that we were working with in Alaska. We were planning on using hair for a certain type of analysis until we found out from the communities that hair is sacred, and so we should not do that. And so we quickly changed the way we were going to approach the study to not use hair since it was sacred for community members.
So you had collaboration with the community members beforehand about their feelings about this research and where your limits should be.
Right. So it seems to be a continual discussion year after year. So we'll start off with what we want to pursue in a mutually beneficial research project, and then that may evolve as we go back and learn about the results and mm-hmm. other things change. And so it changes throughout the lifetime of the partnership.
And you feel the same way, Barbara?
Yes. Yeah. It's actually been a pretty interesting relationship that we have with Ripon and his team. It makes us feel that we're not just subjects of research and that we're actually a part of it and helping to drive it.
Were you ever fearful that once the scientists came in and were doing genetic research about the history of your nation, that they might reveal histories or other aspects of your community that you did not ask them to go look at? I'm specifically thinking of other histories before where scientists have come in and done genetic research and were at odds about the history of the nation, where it came from, which they did not want the scientists to explore.
It's pretty well known to the members that this is their territory, and we didn't expect the results to be any different, and they weren't. They actually corroborated what the community has been saying all along. We were more concerned about the relationship because there's nothing more personal than your DNA. And we had spent quite a bit of time with Ripon talking about the proposed research, looking at various informed consents from different organizations and from the University of Illinois, and looking at the ethics of using genetics for research, and came to an understanding and were able to explain the science to the members. And with the informed consents, we were pretty comfortable in having the research go forward.
Yeah,
because we both wanted something out of the relationship.
Dr. Molly, what other research projects are you working with Native American communities on?
Well, right now I have a few projects going on in British Columbia, California, and Alaska, but I'm most involved in the Alaska project right now with Alaska Natives, where we are actually looking at epigenetics, or how the environment can change or mark your genome and the expression of genes. And we're looking at the epigenetics of European contact and colonization to see how this dramatic change in the environment and social lives of indigenous peoples in Alaska may have been affected by European contact and colonization.
And Barbara, does this experience affect any of your treaty negotiations going on now?
Well, not directly, and without being saying what her positions are, but every time that we have the ability to back up our oral histories using other methods, scientific, archaeological, what have you, is always beneficial to us.
That's great. I want to thank you both for taking time to be with us today.
Great. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thanks.
Dr. Rippon Molly is Associate Professor of Anthropology, University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign. Barbara Petzold is Treaty Coordinator at the Metlakatla Treaty Office. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatto. You know the tale of the four little rabbits, Flopsy, Mopsy, Cottontail, and of course, Peter. Author Beatrix Potter imagined and illustrated the world of the bunny in the blue coat, where he pulled up onions, tried to keep from being baked into a pie. Outside of Mr. McGregor's garden and in her own life, Beatrix Potter had a curious eye for the natural world around her. The idea of Peter Rabbit actually came from sketches and observations of her own pet rabbit, Benjamin Bouncer. She also kept hedgehogs, bats, and frogs, and developed a scientific interest in fungi, mushrooms. My next guest is here to tell us about Beatrix Potter's scientific tales. Linda Lear is author of Beatrix Potter, A Life in Nature, and a contributor on the new book out called The Art of Beatrix Potter. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you, Ira. Happy to be here.
Nice to have you. Just a note to our listeners that we're not taking calls today, but you can comment on Twitter at SciFry or at ScienceFriday.com. You know, Linda, most people don't think of Beatrix Potter outside of rabbits. How did you come to her other illustrations?
I've discovered Beatrix Potter when I was in the Science Museum in London and came across these incredible fungi drawings out in the lobby. And in somewhat typical Brit fashion, there were no labels on them. So, and as I inquired, I found out that they were by Beatrix Potter. I had no idea.
Yeah, they're amazing drawings. What struck you about them the most?
Well, they're in beautiful watercolor. They're incredibly detailed. They're scientifically so accurate that now, all these years later, most of them were done in the 1890s. And all these years later, scientists still go up to the Armit Museum in Cumbria to look at her drawings to identify fungi.
Was that the same period of time in history where we saw all these great detailed drawings of flowers and plants, things like that in nature?
The Victorian passion for natural history was ubiquitous, especially in the upper middle classes and upper class. So her father, for example, had a wonderful library of books on nature and all sorts of the sciences. Her uncle, Roscoe, was a royal fellow and a chemist who invented the Bunsen burner. So she had some science in her background, but it was a passionate thing. You know, everybody was drawing flowers or drawing bugs or drawing rabbits.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've also written a biography of Rachel Carson, who helped start the environmental movement. What is there about both of these women that may be similar or captured your interests?
Interesting question. Thank you. both of them were Victorian rebels. Both of them grew up with a lot of restrictions, and both of them sort of dared to break the envelope very cautiously, but nevertheless rebelliously.
Yeah, how did Beatrix Potter break the envelope?
Well, she was born into a very, very well-to-do Unitarian family in 1866, and she had a younger brother. She was educated at home, was not allowed friends. And the family, while they were well-to-do, they were socially ostracized because of their faith in Unitarianism, which was not a popular faith at the time, although always very scientific. And so she had to devise things to keep her occupied. I think the great nemesis of Victorian women was the problem of boredom. So Beatrix Potter early on started drawing and loved drawing. And as you said in your beginning, she started drawing the animals in her schoolroom, she and her brother.
So this is way before she did the children's book series.
Way before. This is almost as an 8, 10-year-old. She was drawing beautifully. She had to take drawing lessons because her parents forced them on her, but she hoped that they would be over soon and that they wouldn't corrupt her own style.
She and her brother had quite the collection of pets that were the basis of many of her drawings, right?
Yes, it would. I don't think her mother ever came up to the third floor nursery, or certainly didn't come very often. And she had some snakes and some unsavory things that I don't think her mother would have approved of. But they drew them, and then when the animals died, especially the rabbits and the hedgehogs and the things that they really liked to draw, they would boil the skeletons and then reassociate the bones so that they could be anatomically correct. So if you look at her rabbits, you'll see that she knows every muscle.
Talking with Linda Lear, author of Beatrix Potter, A Life in Nature, and also a contributor to The Art of Beatrix Potter, Sketches, Paintings, and illustrations. And I want to go to one illustration, one beautiful sketch in the book about the spiders. I mean, I'm looking at an illustration of a jumping spider, and it's very technical. I mean, all the tiny little hairs, the details. How is she able to observe these details and get them so accurate?
Well, she hung out a lot at the Natural Science Museum, which was a place that she was allowed to go as a single woman, and went often and spent hours, got to know the curators, and drew on site the specimens that they had, and this was one of them. It's a quite remarkable drawing because of the detail, and this is in watercolor.
There's another illustration of fossils and hand tools, which they sound dull, but it's really appealing. How she captures this thing.
It's very appealing. This is the advantage she had in travel when the family removed from their house in London to go to a country house or to go away so that the spring cleaning could happen. And one of the fossils is interesting. I think she almost got interested enough in geology that she could have pursued it. But then again, there was no money in it, and how could a woman, you know, really get anywhere except be a associate assistant, lower level person at the British Museum? So that didn't appeal. But these fossils are three dimensional. She's captured the nooks and crannies, and the all in watercolor again. They leap off the page. They're just extraordinary.
They are, and you know it's, and when you look at it, because they are three dimensional. I got the feeling that she wasn't just trying to be an artist here, but she was trying to be a scientist.
Absolutely. She was trying to be a scientist and use her art to further the science. She got a commission from the Morley College for Men to draw specimens of bugs, insects, for their classes. Then this she did very well, and it was a donation, if you will. She was being a good upper class woman by saying that she would give these drawings to the college so that they could have them in their science classes. But she was that good. And then we have fungi.
Oh yeah,
which did become a huge passion for her. And first, her interest in fungi was imaginary. She loved to watch fungi bloom. She loved their colors. She talked about, made up a rhyme about nid, nid, noddy lying in a row and how the wind would blow and their little leaves and heads would shake. She illustrated lots of fungi as a fantasy kind of thing. Then she got interested because of a Scotsman in Perthshire, where they vacationed in the summer, who was a naturalist. His name was Charles McIntosh, and he was quite a wonderful naturalist. But he only had one hand, and he could do microscopic work, but he could not draw. So they made a deal that he would teach her about fungi and about their various parts of the fungus, and she would draw the fungus for him and send it to him. When he sent her live samples, she would send them back to Perth.
Yeah. She has an illustration going back to that mushroom, because you brought it up, and it is such a wonderful drawing of a crimson wax cap mushroom. And she shows the details of the underside of the cap, but she also has the grass growing at the base of the mushroom.
Right. She put it in the ground. And she also showed the underside and the stem. And this was Charles McIntosh. He taught her how to dissect the mushroom, how to show its gills, and how to show where it was planted and what the kind of condition it might grow in.
Mm-hmm. And she wasn't just drawing these mushrooms, but actually coming up with scientific ideas about them.
Yes, she was. She really was interested in how spores germinate. And she had a theory. Turns out it wasn't symbiosis, but it was close. It was part of the theories that were hot during the 1890s, and that was the subject of the paper that she wrote for the Linnaean Society.
Talk a little bit more about the Linnaean Society of London and how her uncle helped her get in there.
Well, it's a story of scientific jealousy, actually. The director of Kew Gardens, Sir Thistleton Dyer, if you will, had dismissed Beatrix when she got a ticket to do some research at Kew, dismissed her theories and dismissed her drawings about how spores might germinate. But one of the other scientists, botanists at Kew, took her seriously. And and her uncle, Sir Henry Roscoe, took offense that Thistleton Dyer had mistreated his niece and been abrupt and surly. And so he encouraged Beatrix to write this paper, which she did, and all the research in the family kitchen, which turned out, of course, to be a pretty bad place because the drawings got contaminated. But she was encouraged by him to do it, and she was interested enough to see it through. And then this other botanist from Kew actually read the paper at the meeting because she couldn't attend.
Wow, I never realized about that about her. I guess most people never thought about that.
No. And then she's Beatrix Hodder could have been any sort of natural scientist she wanted to be. She was that smart, that dedicated, and that good a scholar. But the only science that did not entice her was astrology. She said that the stars gave her a tisic, which means a headache.
So what was it that stopped her from pursuing that interest?
Money and sex, I guess I would say. Money in the sense that she was after a little money of her own to become independent. And she found that by selling drawings as cards to a very fine printer in London, she could make a little money of her own. And that's how she started illustrating small books or books for children. She sold some drawings in the 1890s and was very proud of herself. Sex, because she was a woman, and she did give this incredible paper on the spores of a fungi that she was researching to the Linnaean Society, but she couldn't attend. No women were allowed. No women were allowed in. No women were members. But she did try to offer a scientific paper.
That's quite interesting. How did the idea for Peter Rabbit come about? How did that get published?
Through this card dealer, actually, through her connections with cards. But she drew this letter. The first letter was a letter to the little boy who was the son of her first governess, her very fond first governess. He was sick in bed, and so she was trying to entertain him. And so she said, I think I'll tell you the tale of Peter Rabbit. And she drew the letter and sent it off, and he loved it. And she sent more. He had several brothers and sisters. She kept sending them letters. She wrote letters to children of all sorts, illustrated letters. Her former governess, now friend, knew that Beatrix was trying to get a little money of her own and suggested that she take that letter and have it republished, which she did. At first, she was turned down by seven or eight publishers who I think didn't like it mostly because it was not in color. But she drew this little book, and then she decided she'd just publish it herself. So we have self-publishing back in the 1890s. It did get published. It did get picked up because she agreed to publish it and to redraw it in color and after she printed her own copies, and then it went gangbusters.
Quite interesting. Talking with Linda Lear, author of Beatrix Potter, A Life in Nature, and a contributor to The Art of Beatrix Potter, on Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Did her views on nature inform the stories of Peter Rabbit or any of her other characters, you think?
Yes, she didn't believe in evolution at the time. I mean, it was a very new thing. But she knew nature as being very rough and red in tooth and claw. So there are stories, most of her stories often have an element of danger in them, not just being put in a pie, but, you know, the badgers and the foxes and raiding houses. She's always got something in there that's a little bit dangerous and shows us that nature is unpredictable, that we aren't in charge.
Nature's unforgiving.
And unforgiving.
Huh. So what made her decide to sort of switch careers then?
Well, no, she was looking always for something useful to do because, you know, women in Victorian times didn't have useful jobs. So drawing and learning about the natural world was something that Victorians were very excited about. I mean, it's the heyday of natural history. And her father was also a photographer. Her mother was an artist. Her brother became an artist. So drawing the world around her was what she could do to keep from being so bored. And so on vacations and travels with her family to the countryside, which they did do, often, she drew what she saw, and that's how the letters to children also started.
After she was done with the illustrations and moved on to the children's books, did she ever talk or think about, hey, maybe I'll revisit doing these illustrations about nature again?
No, I don't think she ever did. She was, by that time, she was very busy being a farmer and a wife and a sheep farmer and growing vegetables and thinking about how to finish another book before her eyesight went.
One last question. Do you think there were other women of the Victorian era who you came across during your research who might have gone into science also?
Absolutely, absolutely. And there are lots. Emma Cons was one, and there's a woman who studied shellfish is another. They were all in the same sort of group of highly industrious, bright, educated women who were terribly bored and had to find something to do.
Well, maybe we can talk you into writing a book about.
Maybe.
Another book.
Maybe.
Well, we're very happy to have your other books. Linda Lear, author of Beatrix Potter, A Life in Nature, and a contributor on this new book out called The Art of Beatrix Potter. Wonderful illustrations make a great holiday gift. And you can see images of Beatrix Potter's drawings on our website at sciencefriday.com/Potter. Thank you for taking time to be with us today, and happy holidays to you.
Same to you, Ira. It's been a pleasure.
Me too. After the break, we're going to look at a few of the ambitious architectural projects of New York City that never came to be. We'll be right back after this short break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. The New York City skyline is one of the most iconic in the world. The Empire State Building, the World Trade Center, the Brooklyn Bridge, and of course my favorite, the Chrysler Building. But for all the structures New York City is known for, there are dozens that were never made. Skyscrapers built along the George Washington Bridge, a floating airport on the Hudson River, a dome covering Midtown Manhattan. Sounds crazy, right? But they were real ideas once. now all that's left of these whimsical plans are artists' drawings and renderings, which have been carefully collected into a new book by my next guest. And to look at them makes you wonder if just maybe in some alternative universe, those things really do exist. Sam Lubell is a contributing writer for Wired and co-author of the new book, Never Built New York. And we won't be taking your calls today, but you can comment on Twitter at SciFry or at ScienceFriday.com. Welcome back, Sam.
Thanks, Ira. Great to be here.
Now, your new book is like an encyclopedia of New York projects that were never completed. How do you find about about these things if they were never built? How did you start your journey on that?
Well, that is the challenge. You can't go to the library and look for things that never happen because they don't get documented very often. But what you do is you really get to know the history of people that build in the city. So you look for all the firms that are building now, and you ask them what didn't happen. And a lot of what you do is you go to archives that are collecting that collect the work of all the architects throughout the history and the engineers and the builders throughout the history of the city, well over 25, 30, even more of those archives. And those are not just in New York, but they're all around the country. And they've got incredible stuff that's just sitting in vaults, sitting in cold storage.
Do they ever think that maybe they can resurrect those ideas and someone will pull them out 20, 30, 40 years later?
I think I don't know if the archivists think that, but there's always that thought that some of these things might come back. And like everything else, ideas do come around. And, you wonder, some of these ideas actually could. So it's a good question.
Let's go to some of the ideas, some of the projects. And some of them would have dramatically altered the landscape of New York, for example. There was one plan from 1911 to extend the bottom of Manhattan into the bay, almost to Staten Island.
Yeah, pretty close.
What was that? What was the idea there?
Well, that was by a really well-respected civil engineer named T. Kennard Thompson, who had worked on several of the most important projects in the city at the time. He was not a crackpot by any means. And for over 20, like almost close to 30 years, he proposed this idea called the City of New Manhattan. And the idea was basically to build another Manhattan off the tip of Manhattan, as you said, extending all the way down to basically to Staten Island, swallowing Governor's Island, swallowing basically all of New York Bay, and built all on landfill. And it wasn't a pie in the sky idea. He was collaboration with other engineers. He was talking to people in the city. He had the backing of a lot of business groups in Lower Manhattan who were scared that the momentum of business was moving northward toward Midtown, which it was, and they were no longer going to be the center of things. But if things went south, they'd remain the center. And he tried. It was on the cover of the New York Times. It was on the cover of most major newspapers at some point over that 20 years, several times, if not once on each of those. So this was not a joke of an idea. And it was a time when ideas like this weren't considered that far-fetched, amazingly.
Yeah. Yeah. And I noticed there were ideas in the book for making sort of a beach out of the west side of New York, which I have said all the time, if you've got coastlines like you have in Chicago and big cities, why not have a beach or something? What happened to those ideas?
Well, yeah, I mean, people have thought of Manhattan is a very limited space, and it's one of the most, aggressively built areas in the world. So there's always ideas for how do you make it more livable? How do you make it more space in it? There was an idea by a developer who we like to think of a never built all-star named William Zeckendorf, and his sons are still practicing, still developing, for an airport along the entire west side of Manhattan, covering more than 40 blocks. And you'd have an airport above, a giant concrete landing strip. You'd have boats coming in from the side. You'd have office buildings along the other side, kind of using every square inch. And you have other people that thought of floating kind mm-hmm. of infrastructure that was going to create, new performing arts spaces. And, some of these ideas, now you have this plus pool, which is going to be building a pool in the, floating in the river in Manhattan. So these kinds of ideas, these kind of maybe crazy ideas, they keep coming back. And these ideas are not always as foolish as we think they are in retrospect.
There was a very interesting Buckminster Fuller, yeah. wanted to put, and you have it in the book, a giant dome over the middle of Manhattan.
Yeah, and that one, a lot of the ideas we have were very close to happening. That's not one that was particularly close, although it was very well researched, and Bucky Fuller wanted to build domes pretty much everywhere. He had been talking to a developer about doing one further upstate, a serious plan to do that. And then he consequently came up with this plan to basically, shelter New York from all the elements. It was a time when people really believed in the power of technology, and they thought, we can do kind of anything. We're building domes. We're building spaceships that go to the moon. Why can't we build a dome over Manhattan to, get rid of all this pollution, get rid of all the problems of weather? Because as we know, New York doesn't have the best weather. It really was a time when these things were thought that they were possible. And it's both scary and exciting that people were thinking this way.
They also scrapped plans to fill in the East River. There were plans to fill in the Hudson River.
Yeah.
Plans to fill in the East River.
Yeah. Yeah, and a lot, like I said, Kennard Thompson was the most fully fleshed out. Some of those other plans you have, like in different science periodicals, people were coming up with these ideas all the time.
I think modern mechanics is for filling in the Hudson in 1934.
Yeah, but some of those, again, some of these were engineers. One engineer was working with the city, was coming up with this. The idea was, you have two rivers. Why not fill one of them in and you get more space? I mean, we have so many problems of space in this city, and you have these two rivers around here. You've got a backup plan with the Hudson. Why not fill in the East, and you've got like twice the space, you've got twice the tax revenue. Let's do this. And people were building people had already built the Panama Canal. They were filling in most of Boston with landfill. This wasn't considered that far-fetched. I think you subsequently had overreach to an extent where things kind of got out of hand in the mid-century, that people now are so hesitant to do this kind of grand thinking, both for better and for worse. I think we have environmental responsibilities and knowledge that we didn't have then, but also we're scared to think big, I think people are a little tired of that. So there's pros and cons to these ideas.
One of the great parts about your book, Never Built New York, are the great color photos you have. I mean, the actual renderings, the drawings, the newspaper clippings, everything. How did you find all of these? That's really what makes the book work.
Yeah.
Big, beautiful color photos and drawings.
Yeah, well, I think one of the things that people really respond to about this book, and we also did a book in Los Angeles, Never Built Los Angeles, as well as an exhibition, is these drawings. Because to a large extent, this art of architectural drawing is sort of dying, if not close to dead. And for a long time, this was the way people rendered things, and they did it in such an artful, extremely beautiful way. And you go to these archives that I was mentioning. You go to the Avery Archive at Columbia. You go to archives at Yale, Princeton, Columbia, you go to the New York Historical Society, you pull these things out, they're the size of a table, and they're absolutely stunning. They take your breath away. And it's a way of seeing the world that we are now losing to this hyper-real vision that computers are creating, which is a very limited palette, created by programs. Mm-hmm. It's not out of people's imaginations. There's not the sort of immediate response that we have. We're sort of kind of jaded by the way we see things. But people it's just so absolutely beautiful. And you find these in archives, and then archivists who know the material so well will find more and things that, oh, by the way, there's this amazing, drawing of City Hall. They're going to knock down City Hall and build this. We found that at the archives at the University of Pennsylvania, the archivist.
Wow.
We didn't know that there was a plan. He just kind of pulled it out of nowhere. And that's how you find a lot of this stuff.
One of the more interesting, there's so much going on in this book. One of the most innovative designs, I think, is a Frank Lloyd Wright design for recreating Ellis Island.
Yeah.
Wow. You have to see it to believe it.
Yeah.
I mean, that's another point. You reminded me of that about the drawings. This is not the Ellis Island we have today.
That's definitely true. The book shows these sites that you think are sort of sacrosanct.
Yeah.
It's Ellis Island. And it's like, well, actually, because Ellis Island, only served its purpose until the 1950s. And then the national government put it out to bid for developers. And there was a plan for a prison at one time. There was a plan for there was a proposal for this great resort that didn't happen. And the highest bid actually came from this group that hired Frank Lloyd Wright to come up with what was called the Key Plan. And it was basically a city within a city.
I love how they describe it here. You say, casual inspired living minus the usual big city clamor.
Yes, exactly.
it's like Ellis Island.
It's an escape. It's not the place to come into America. It's the place to escape from New York, I guess. And Frank Lloyd Wright sort of espoused that. He was famous for Broadacre City, which sort of was a living away from the city. And you've got, you know, his organic architecture all around you. You've got greenery around you. You've got these double bubble domes around you that are schools and theaters. And he designs every square inch of it, from the boats to the toilet flushers, everything. It's very Frank Lloyd Wright vision, and amazing. I mean, the drawing, again, I saw that at the Avery Archive at Columbia, and I almost, you want to pass out when you see
it's
how
amazing.
Beautiful it is.
It's amazing. One of the key architects of New York was Robert Moses. Yeah. His highways, the Triborough Bridge is his, and the highways all around New York City. He couldn't finish. He was called the King of New York at one point. That's how powerful he was. But he really wanted to bring a super highway down right down the middle of New York, didn't he?
He wanted to bring several highways down the middle of New York. And he was an example of just how powerful bureaucrats had become. And he was the most powerful of them all, as you know. And I think people kind of think he built everything he wanted, but never built show when, you know, the tides of history, and the tide of history started to turn against him. And that's when you get these never built Moses projects.
Right.
And I think a lot of people know about the Lower Manhattan Expressway that Jane Jacobs famously helped lead the charge against, and that would have basically wiped out Soho and most of the Lower East Side, which is terrifying. But not at all. It was part of the popular conscience that things like that were happening, and it was sort of a normal thing. But he also wanted to build a highway down, actually about a block from here on 32nd Street through Mid Manhattan, up a raised highway going through buildings called the Mid Manhattan Expressway, and that came very close to being completed. I don't think people realize that was another one. It's astonishing.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI Public Radio International. Talking with Sam Lubell, co-author of Never Built New York, co-author with Greg Golden, and the graphics in this. If you've ever wondered why don't they build that? It seems like somebody had at one point thought of some idea.
Yeah.
Was there a period where most activity was going on? Can you narrow it down?
It's a really good question, because, you know, we obviously can't find everything. But from what we found, the most fertile periods for what we found were sort of, I think, at the turn of the century and the beginning of the 20th century, when the city was really forming its modern self. You start with the Beaux-Arts plans that didn't happen, and then you move into stuff, the famous, you know, Art Deco buildings. You see the ones that were built, the Chrysler Building, the Empire State, but there were so many that weren't. And I think the thing that really, the time when we really saw the most of those was during the Great Depression. It's like, you know, the great collector of never built projects. And there were some
right.
that, there was a tower near Madison Square Park that was going to be 100 stories and got knocked down to about 29 because of the Great Depression, although you can see it still has the width for that tall of a building. And those projects go on and on. And then I think the next time was when another iteration of the city, which was the mid-century, which we were just talking about, which is when I think the city was in a lot of ways trying to rethink itself and sort of save itself from its decline. And you had people like Robert Moses trying to build these gigantic schemes that would have, they think, saved the city. I don't think they would have.
And then you have some things that have never still been built, right, or used to be built, right? And I'm thinking especially about Penn Station.
Yeah.
Penn Station used to be this gorgeous thing.
Oh, yeah.
That they took apart, what, in the 60s? They took it down.
Yeah.
And they still have not figured out how to put it back.
No, and we've got more than half a dozen attempts to build a new Penn Station that may have recreated or at least captured some of the magic of the original, although you never really can. It was astounding. And on the other side of the coin, we have more than half a dozen attempts to knock down Grand Central Station.
Right.
Again, these things that you think are sacred in the city really weren't, and that one came within a whisker.
And wasn't Jackie Kennedy?
She was a big part.
Big part of saving
it. There was one of several plans, a skyscraper by Marcel Breuer, who designed the Whitney, among many other things, was going to basically be chomped right on top of Grand Central Station and basically destroying it. That was killed by a preservationist led by Jackie Kennedy, and the fight for that went all the way to the Supreme Court really kind of gave the fledgling preservation movement its teeth for once.
Are there projects going on all the time we don't know about?
Oh, yeah.
Somebody wants to do this and that, and they're just sitting on table. Do you know of any that are really creative that you'd like to see?
That I'd like to see now?
Yeah. I mean, is there something on somebody's drafting table now that you came across and said, oh, that would be a great idea?
Well, you're always coming across really good ideas. You know, I think there haven't been as many grand ideas, I think, to change the city lately as there. I think the one exception is the High Line.
Right.
And now there's a plan called the Low Line, which I don't think is the same scope of that, but it's, you know, it's interesting to, they're trying to rethink subterranean space. And
that's to go under the west side.
It's to go under the east, lower east side.
Lower east side.
And it's really much more moderate in scale. And I think that the name is a little bit of branding, but it's an interesting concept, which is how do you bring natural light? How do you bring new life into subterranean areas of Manhattan? It's like, again, rethinking how you live in Manhattan and how you use this limited space. I like that plus pool, and that could we'll see if that will be built. We don't know, but I like the idea of how do you live in the river, and the river, how do you make it a place that's not a place you're scared of and a place that you want to embrace? I love the idea of using the city in new ways, and people are always thinking of new ways to do that.
And a lot of new ways that never got built are in Sam Lubell's book, contributing writer for Wired and co-author of this book. Great book. Great holiday book, Sam. Never Built New York. Sam Lubell, thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Thanks, Ira. Great to be here.
One last thing before we go. There's still time to join us for Science Club. And this time we've invited you to break it down. Rotary phones, baseballs, complex molecules, you name it. Break something down. That's we're giving you permission to bust stuff up. So if you need something to do this holiday weekend, it's not too late to join the fun. Break something down and tweet it or share it on Instagram with the hashtag IBrokeItDown. Or visit sciencefriday.com/scienceclub to submit your project for a chance to be included in our on-air wrap-it-up on December 9th. That's all the time we have. Charles Berquist is our director. Senior producer, Christopher Intagliata. Our producers are Alexa Lim, Annie Minoff, Christy Taylor, Katie Heiler. Luke Raskin is our video producer. Rich Kim, our technical director. Sarah Fishman and Jack Horowitz are our engineers and the controls here at the studios of our production partners, the City University of New York. Have a great holiday weekend. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.